WrestleSpective Radio is not affiliated with World Wrestling Entertainment, TNA Wrestling, Ring of Honor Wrestling, or any other sports entertainment entity or personality.
You're listening to WrestleSpective Radio. Learn to love it.
Greetings and welcome to WrestleSpective. Before we begin, I want to tell you a little bit about our sponsor, RotoReels.com, which is a great place to go if you want DVDs and downloads of all the best wrestling out there. So check it out, RotoReels.com. And my guest today, returning to the program, he is the co-host of What a Maneuver and many other wonderful podcasts, Joe Drilling. Welcome back to the show.
Thank you so much, Jason. It's been a while. Every time we do this, I feel like it's a while, and then we do like two at a time, and then it's like months before we do another one. But it's true. I'm the co-host of What a Maneuver and other podcasts. And I would like to say, as it pertains to your sponsor, that he's been on your show, hasn't he?
Yes.
Franny from Ruto Reels. He's also been on an episode of What a Maneuver. So anybody who is a fan of RotoReels.com should meander on over to the What a Maneuver site and check out the episode that he was on.
You definitely should. I agree.
Which, in a way that I did not plan at all, actually ended up to be a very lucha-heavy episode of What a Maneuver.
Nice. So, we are talking about, not speaking of lucha at all, we are talking about the main event of WCW Uncensored 1999. It is Hulk Hogan against Ric Flair, and I can already hear you sigh. So,
yeah.
You're not really a fan of, I'm guessing, the match and or the story. What about it?
Yeah, so I got to say, I requested this main event because I feel like you had emailed me at one point, probably like 2 or 3 months ago now when we first talked about doing this, and you had emailed me about, are there any other ones that I'd wanted to do and that kind of thing. And this is the one because I realized, I pinpointed, and I don't remember how this came up. It was probably during a recording of an episode of What a Maneuver, but this main event is the moment at which I stopped giving even the slightest squirt of piss about WCW. This was the last WCW pay-per-view that I watched as it happened. And when this match was over, I was like, that was so bad, so disjointed, so narratively nonsensical that I this is the straw that broke the camel's back. I no longer care about WCW at all. And from then on until, WCW invaded WWE, or WWF, I guess it still was at that time. I really, at this point, I was just ECW and WWF from this point until the invasion angle was the next time I watched anything WCW related. I probably, like, channel surfed past an episode of Nitro or an episode of Thunder here and there, I guess, but nothing that stands out. I don't remember any of that. I didn't watch any of the New Blood Millionaires Club stuff. I didn't watch any of the Russo stuff. I didn't like none of that. I was totally tuned out for it because this match was the tipping point for me where I was like, I can't do this anymore. This is so bad.
Mm-hmm. Now, I definitely see where you're coming from because this was definitely a period where there was a lot of just nonsense going on, a lot of storylines that were really bizarre and not particularly very good. Recycling of big matches, Hogan and Flair, although both these guys were pretty hot at this point, and you can kind of justify them going back to it because of the stories that had led to it, but it was still kind of a period in which WCW had been definitely a lot of stagnation, a lot of issues like that. So I totally see where you're coming from. But I don't know. I do feel like this match works a lot better out of context than it does in context.
Yes, I will agree with that. It works better out of context. It's still not good.
Yeah, it's fascinating though. I have to say that
it is. It is. It's almost. I think one of my notes asks the question if this is postmodern professional wrestling.
Perhaps.
Like at the point when Hogan starts to Hulk up, and I don't want to jump ahead of ourselves, but like that's the moment where I was like, that makes no sense. Why would that even happen? Like this must be like the pro wrestling equivalent of a Beckett play. Like that's the only thing that I can think at this point that makes me not just get angry. Like I don't know.
Well, let's talk a little bit about the story going in here.
Yes.
Flair had come back late in 98 after having real life issues with Eric Bischoff that led to him not being a part of WCW for 6-7 months. Came back in the fall, didn't really do a whole lot until Starrcade 98, in which he lost the match to Bischoff. But then the next night on Nitro, he and Bischoff had a rematch in which Flair, with a little bit of help from a one-night-only returning Randy Savage, was able to win the presidency. I remember especially the moment with Flair and Dusty Rhodes sharing like a big hug and just feeling like, you know, warm and fuzzy with, you know, the old rivals, you know, embracing that one time. And Flair able to win the WCW presidency, kind of restore a little bit of normalcy back to, you know, having a good guy authority figure after Bischoff had mostly been the dominant authority figure for the last year or two with, you know, a couple of, you know, J.J. Dillon, Thurnin here and there. And then pretty soon afterward, there was the infamous finger poke of doom, of course.
So that was one of my notes as well, and I knew you would know the answer to that. And I was going to ask, is this the Hogan title reign that we're in here, that is the one that started with the finger poke of doom?
Yes, it began with the finger poke of doom. And, you know, obviously there's a lot negative you can say about the finger poke of doom, but it was a pretty hot angle that got people riled up and got a little bit of momentum behind Hogan again, which, you know, long term was not a good thing, but short term had its dividends. And this sort of led to Flair and Hogan. They had a match at Super Brawl, best known for David Flair, after he had been tempted many times by Samantha, as she was called, the future Tori Wilson. He turned on Rick and helped Hogan win that match. So this is the rematch of the idea of Flair getting his vengeance for all these, you know, nefarious things that the NWO has done, running roughshod over the last couple of months, so on and so forth. But it takes a bit of an odd turn in the month between Super Brawl and Uncensored, where Ric Flair just out of nowhere starts acting like a huge dick.
Yeah, I was really hazy on who was who here in terms of you know, the baby face and the heel, and it seemed like Hogan was the heel for most of the match, and then he hulks up, and I just really didn't, even now, at the time, I feel like I wasn't, so to frame it for me personally, at this time, I was huge into wrestling, but I was way more of a WWF and ECW fan already by the time I had reached this point. Because remember, as I said, this was the straw that broke the camel's back. So I was on my way. There were a lot of straws already on my back as it pertained to WCW. So I was watching a lot more ECW and a lot more WWF.
Yeah.
You know, so I feel like I was hazy about that aspect of it even at the time, as far as Flair's dickishness, the possible motivations for that, who was supposed to be the heel here, and, you know, that kind of thing, which is weird because this seems to be a stronger babyface reaction that Hogan will get in this course of this match, albeit somewhat briefly, than he got in all of his full-on Hulkster stuff in 1996 until the NWO, because by that point, the WCW audience was really not digging babyface Hogan. But by this point, it's really weird. So
yeah,
that's a part that I wasn't fully aware of, or why. So we don't know why Flair just started being a douchebag. Like, it just happened.
Yeah, it just sort of randomly happened in a Nitro. Like, on a Nitro, he sets up a match with Goldberg and just sort of kind of turns there. But there's not really, I mean, I think you can look at what happens here, and you can, even though it's not really necessarily explained, I think you can draw the conclusion that Flair is suddenly is sort of being driven insane a little bit by the fact that his son turned against him and turned on and joined with Hulk Hogan, and that's sort of a what he is doing is sort of a overcompensation for that for a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, there's also the fact that Ric Flair just isn't a nice guy, you know. I mean, even good guy Ric Flair is mostly bad, you know.
Right.
But yeah, the motivation for Flair turning is suspect. The idea that fans would want to be into Hulk Hogan again so quickly after, like, he had done one of the worst things that, you know, anyone had ever done to Ric Flair, or, you know, so on and so forth, and had, you know, reformed the NWO and done this horrible thing to Goldberg and blah, 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 you know, after this big, giant, you know, huge NWO reunion thing, to the fact that, like, oh, we're just going to forget about all that and Hogan's going to be a good guy again right away, that was kind of iffy. It certainly bothered me at the time, and I was still pretty invested in WCW, although I was more in to WWE at the time, and definitely, like, the bad was starting to outweigh the good in WCW to a large extent.
Yeah. And actually, this card, and I don't remember much of it, but the card itself actually looks like it wasn't that bad. Leading up to this,
the Horseman match against Henning and Wyndham's really good. I'm thinking of the Hack Bam Bam Bigelow match at the next pay per view is really good. The Super Brawl, the pay per view before this, and Spring Stampede, the pay per view after this, both of 99, are like two of the best WCW pay per views ever. They're both really, really fantastic. This one is, you know, has some good moments, but isn't nearly as good. Although it still has some good stuff.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, the Horseman versus Hennig and Wyndham, I would imagine, is fantastic. Yeah. I recall liking it again. It's been since this aired, since I had watched any part of it, and I didn't have time to. I wanted to watch the full, you know, the full thing, but I didn't have a chance, unfortunately.
Yeah.
But, you know, I would imagine that the Saturn versus Jericho dog collar match was probably decent. Is that the one? Saturn was already wearing the dress at this time, right?
I'm pretty sure, yeah.
Okay. And there was that had to be very close to Jericho's final WCW appearance.
Yeah, he was gone by not long after this, actually. Yeah, he lost the U.S. title tournament match to Steiner after this, and then I think that was basically the end.
Okay.
So.
And then the worst kept secret in professional wrestling history.
Right. Yes, definitely.
The new year is the countdown to the millennium.
Right. Okay. The other weird thing about this, the build up to this match, besides all of what we talked about, is it's a first blood match, but they were not able to use the word blood to hype it.
Okay, that I totally didn't remember. Why weren't they, just because Turner's standards and practices?
Yeah, like it was a weird period where their standards and practices got really strict about things, and apparently they couldn't use the word blood. So Flair was having to sort of, like, allude to it without actually using the word blood. So it was sort of like, I don't know how much of the crowd was necessarily expecting this to be a first blood match when it happened, because they were so, you know, vague about it. And they hyped up the cage, like, they even have like a video, a sort of a strange video package of them, like
the cage being built. Yeah. Built
with no words, no music, just like sound effects that almost sound like an electric shock that like Frankenstein would get.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
And then you see at the end WCW welded into, you know, part of the cage. So it's impressive looking cage.
It is until they get into it. And there's a moment in the match where Hogan is like cheese gratering Flair's head, and it looks like the cage is about to like break open.
Yeah, it definitely has some give, or a lot of give, I guess.
Yes, more than its fair share of give.
So, but yeah, I mean, that's sort of the crazy thing, is that they can't use the word blood to hype it up. They finally do say first blood in the announcing here, but I'm 99% sure they could not use the term first blood during the hype for the match.
That is ridiculous. That's like on the level of the international object. You know, it's just dumb.
Yeah,
like, it doesn't. Well, anyways.
Yeah.
Whatever. So are we going to start with Michael Buffer? Because everybody knows how much you and I love Michael Buffer as a wrestling ring announcer.
We certainly do. It's a world heavyweight cage match like no other in the history of professional wrestling.
I have that exact note with quotes around it. A heavyweight cage match like no other.
So there's barbed wire on the top of the cage, and there's no doors in the cage, which is sort of unusual for a WCW cage.
For any cage, I would say, well, not any. Indies use a lot, a lot of indies, I think, just get some pieces of fence and like zip tie them together. So
yeah.
It makes sense that they don't have doors. But for any major promotion, it's weird for the cage not to have doors, which I get it. That's cool. I hope they didn't really waste the money on building a special cage with no doors, though. That seems to be... we're going to build a special cage with no doors that we're going to use once.
Yeah. In fact, I feel like they used a similar cage in 98 because I remember the Hogan Savage match had that kind of cage. I remember there being a Savage match against like DDP on Nitro, which was like his last match before he was gone for a year, where they had that kind of cage. So, because I remember. At the end of it, they have like Kevin Nash finding the controls to it and then hitting the button.
God, I do remember that.
Yeah.
Was that Savage match the one you're alluding to from 98? Was that the one with the really weird like non-finish where they just kind of stopped and then left? Savage climbed up to the top of the cage but didn't leave the cage. And some people interfered or something. And then I just remember Savage yelling, "I never liked you," at Hogan. And then they like just kind of dispersed. And left.
That may have been that. Yeah, I feel like there was a finish to that match, but I don't remember what it was. I know Savage came off the top of the cage, but and came down and did like an axe handle off top of the cage. But I don't know. It's been a while since I've seen that one. Probably 14 years. So
right.
So
Buffer lays out the rules. He introduces everybody. He lavishes praise on Hogan as usual, and Buffer just like I've mentioned this because he was doing the pay-per-view announcing in 96. So, of course, I've mentioned this many times on What a Maneuver, but he just isn't. And in fact, the episode I'm editing now, which covers War Games 96, that I'm about to post, we go on a tear about just how he's not. It's not that he is not a good ring announcer. He has a great voice. He has a great presence. But one, they were paying him way too much damn money. And two, he's not a wrestling ring announcer, and you can tell he doesn't really care about wrestling. He doesn't get wrestling. He doesn't want to get wrestling. He mispronounces people's names, gives the wrong towns that they're from, says things like a heavyweight cage match like no other. Like, it's just, he's not a wrestling ring announcer.
His language that he uses is completely different from the language that WCW uses.
Right.
Yeah, the way he communicates things, which sometimes works because it gives it kind of like a classic feel, but a lot of times it just ends up being strange and jarring. We're in Louisville, Kentucky. Worth noting, I suppose. If Flair wins, he will be WCW president for life, and if he loses, he will be banned for life. So
I don't. There's a point at which in my brain I stop. Like, not that I just stop believing, but I stop even acknowledging when they say things like that in professional wrestling. Mm-hmm. I feel like those words should never ever be used in professional wrestling.
Unless you're like NWO for life, I would agree.
Right. Well, obviously, everybody's NWO for life. Sure. But to say that he'll be the president, because obviously that didn't happen, right? Like, I don't even think it was very long that he was president.
I think he lost it finally in June.
Yeah, so 3 more months.
Right. He lost in a match of Sting, I know that. So.
Yeah. And if he had lost and left, he would not have stayed gone.
No, he would not have stayed. Well, in fact, this happened, of course, 5 years before, 4.5 years before, with Hogan and Flair in a cage match that Flair lost and was forced to retire and was gone for, 6 months.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
Right. Macho Man Savage lost to the Ultimate Warrior at WrestleMania 6. 7.
7? Yes, 7.
Yeah, WrestleMania 7. And he was gone for 3 months, I think.
No, it was like his first match back was I think it was this Tuesday in Texas. So it was close to 9 months.
Okay. So, but it's important to note that Savage loses a retirement match at WrestleMania 7, then wins the World Championship at WrestleMania 8.
That's true, yes.
So it's just – I just hate that kind of hyperbole. You know, it's – I don't know. I just don't like it because it's not that it's dishonest, because I get that wrestling is a work, but that it's – so overblown at this point, and that every wrestling fan, I mean, I'm sure there are 4-year-old wrestling fans with John Cena foam fingers, you know, who understand that when someone says forever in professional wrestling, it never ever means forever in professional wrestling.
Right. Yeah. It's like, it's fine if the trick works, but if it's clear that the trick isn't working, then it's time to find a new trick.
Right. Exactly. Yeah.
So, Flair is going for his 14th title. As he walks out, he has sort of a stern face. He's cheered heavily. When he gets in the ring, he uses his hand to motion for the mic, but Buffer has his spiel, and he must finish it first before he can give it to Flair.
Of course.
Flair tells Charles Robinson, who is, of course, the referee, later would become famous, has been a referee ever since, and is later would become famous as Little Natch.
I was going to ask if they were calling him, if he had been Little Natch yet.
This is the first, sign that Charles Robinson is going to be in Flair's pocket. I guess that may not be true, because there's a David Flair, Eric Bischoff match that happened on Nitro, in which, a month or two before this, or wait a minute, I'm trying to remember exactly when that was. There's a match in which Robinson gives David Flair a roll of quarters. He nails Bischoff in the head, knocks him out, pins him, and then Bischoff is forced to basically be Flair's indentured servant for 30 days. Mm. And there's skits of him cleaning toilets and so on and so forth, and of Flair doing things to embarrass him. So Robinson, I believe, was the ref. Actually, handed him the quarters at that point. So I guess there was that. But basically, this would be the first time that Robinson showed any heelish tendencies, in Flair's favor, and then of course would eventually do the Flair impersonation. Actually, was very good doing that character. Wasn't necessarily the best, thing for everyone to be doing, but he did a good job with it.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, Flair tells Robinson at this point that he doesn't want any scratches to be used. He wants real blood. The wrestling fans paid for it, so I want you to stop this match at your own discretion, he says. And during this, he also yells at a fan, yelling, "If you don't like it, too bad," kind of thing. So he's acting heelish, at least more than subtly, but.
Well, I don't know, the whole don't stop the match over a scratch thing is a very babyface
true.
To me, it plays, because it's like I don't want Hogan to say he's had enough, just because I put a little blood coming out of his mouth or a little scratch on his forehead,
right. And the idea of giving the fans their money's worth, although you can say he's being disingenuous with it, but whatever. Hogan comes out to the Wolfpack music, plays the guitar with the title. It's spray painted red, and his bandana has an NWO logo that is half in white and half in red.
Yeah. And he comes out to the Wolfpack music.
Right, yes.
Which is not Voodoo Child and not the original NWO music, but the Wolfpack hip-hop music, which is weird.
Wolfpack is back, coming something. Yeah, I don't know. I don't know lyrics, but yes.
Those are the only lyrics that anybody knows.
Don't turn your back on the Wolfpack. You might end up in a body bag. So the Wolfpack, if you turn your back on them, they may actually murder you. So
yes,
you should be careful with them. Right.
You should. Yep. Or they might just poke you in the chest.
They might. That's their other big offensive maneuver.
It's true.
It's one of the two. And then Michael Buffer dramatically says, "Let's lower the cage," and the cage lowers. And there's big sound effects and music for the cage lowering. It's been reasonably impressive.
Yes, I'm impressed by the way that cage is lowered.
Yes. So Tony calls this Charles Robinson's first big title match. Now, I didn't have time to look that up, but I feel like that can't possibly be true.
I wouldn't think so.
Yeah. He had been referee for about 2 years for that. So, certainly could have, Nick Patrick was mostly doing the big ones.
Bad referee, Nick Patrick.
Right, exactly. So. But I feel like Charles Robinson had been doing things before this, doing important things before this. And then Tony does a nice job of summing up Charles Robinson growing up being a huge Flair fan. Tony asking whether he was nervous about doing, you know, this match because, you know, of how much he respects Flair and so on and so forth. So hinting at what's going to come, but not necessarily like overplaying it. It was just kind of a nice, because Tony also talked about his personal experiences of being a fan of Flair's, just like Charles had been. And that was kind of a cool few moments that Tony did.
Yeah,
I thought so. So we get into the match. Hogan shoves Flair down repeatedly, gets the headlock, comes off the ropes and knocks Flair down. So we're getting our traditional Hogan Flair spots for the most part. But I will say that there are a few moments where Flair chops Hogan, and instead of Hogan selling it like he would as a face of either no selling it or not being as damaging as it normally would be, at least particularly in the early portion of the match, he sells it all more like he would as a heel, where it's utter agony for him.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. Like I think the thing about this match is it sort of feels like a double, or the story they're trying to tell seems like a double term, where in the end you're supposed to be for Hulk Hogan and against Ric Flair. But what it really feels more like, it's sort of a match in which they're both moving towards that identity, but at the end of it, I don't think either one is necessarily supposed to be all the way there yet.
No, not at all. I didn't feel that way at the time, and I didn't feel that way having just watched it tonight. It was like, first of all, Hogan was never that over as a babyface. I don't think he was ever as over as a babyface in WCW as the people who initially brought him into WCW wanted him to be. And they pushed him to the point of utter absurdity. I mean, the 3 years before this pay-per-view at Uncensored 96, he essentially destroys every heel, on the WCW roster nearly single-handedly, including Ric Flair. And it just doesn't, like, the more they crammed him down people's throats, the more that the traditional Southern NWA Jim Crockett crowds sort of rejected him. So now he's in the NWO. I think they, by this point, WCW had definitely pushed through to a more mainstream fan and consciousness, as professional wrestling in general, I would say, had. But WCW no longer had to worry about necessarily catering to the classic NWA Jim Crockett type of fan.
Sure.
But still, the NWO was the thing that had been going on forever. The finger poke of doom was so dumb. And even if you don't think it was dumb, it was clearly meant to look like there was cronyism all over the NWO, and that Hogan wasn't justified in holding that title, and that Hogan wasn't, you know. So to try and all of a sudden have him be like, well, he won the title by poking Nash and having Nash lay down for him for God only knows what reason, what in-character motivation Nash would have for doing that. But, you know, now he's going to out-wrestle Ric Flair, and he's going to hulk up in the middle of this cage match, and it just, it doesn't work for me on any level. And I agree that I think that's what they were going for, like a double turn. Like, they wanted, you know, Bret Hart versus Steve Austin. And that's not at all what this match achieves. Mm-hmm. Not remotely.
Yeah. But do you think they were intending to go all the way with it? Or do you think they were, and just it was not well executed? Or do you think they were more going for the middle and then eventually going to get to the full turn later?
I would say, given the people who were running WCW at this time, I think they were going for the full turn.
Okay.
In one shot. And it just fell horrifically short of that.
Okay.
Heenan
goes on about how much he hates Hogan, but it mentions about, of course, how Hogan always gets up for the big matches, and, you know, and he's, of course, he's worried about Flair because Flair's career is on the line, and Heenan's a pro and is, you know, selling that pretty well. After Flair is knocked down, he's cautious. He backs off. We get quite a few woos, but we also get some Hogan chants. So you kind of have a bit of a split crowd. I think Flair's more the favorite, but Hogan certainly has his moments where people are behind him as well.
Yeah.
Hogan gets a knuckle lock, but Flair gets the eyes. And as I mentioned, the chops cause Hogan quite a bit of anguish.
Yes.
And then another chop hurts Hogan, and then Flair goes after the knees. Then Hogan gets a big flurry with a backdrop, three clotheslines. Flair begs off in the corner, so Hogan pulls Flair out by the legs, lands a body slam and two elbows, and then he goes for the third elbow, but fakes it, and then rakes his face with his boot instead. So, Hogan then chokes Flair for a bit, and then Charles Robinson admonishes him a little bit, kind of, you know, a little bit hinting toward the favoritism that he would show, but maybe in a subtle way. Then Hogan chops and punches Flair a bunch in the corners, hits a running clothesline, and Flair flops. And then we get to Hogan playing to the crowd, doing the ear cup. At this point, more boos than cheers, and Tony makes a special mention of, hey, it's been a while since we've seen Hogan do that.
Yeah. And by this point, Flair is bleeding.
I think he's close to it. I don't think he's quite bleeding yet. I mean, there may be like a small cut, but it's not really the point where you know, if you were going by what they would say in the match, that it's not a point where you would feel like they would have to stop it. But that would but soon he would be.
Okay.
So Hogan
is this the figure four?
Hogan gets the figure four. Yeah. At this point, yes. He locks in the figure four.
Worst figure four ever. The way he locks it on looks so goofy.
Yeah, Hogan did a weird figure four.
Yeah, and he always did that. And there's some instances in '96 where he does that as well. And Eric and I have mentioned it, you know, over on our show. Like, he does the weirdest figure four ever. Like,
instead of turning around the leg, he just sort of like bends the legs and he sits down basically. So yeah, it's sort of it's odd. I feel like Dusty did a similar one too.
Yeah.
So, Hogan sort of points at Flair, taunting him. Flair eventually makes the ropes. He gets a few cheap shots, limps over to Hogan.
Shouldn't make a difference. Like, why would Hogan break the hold if he's got the ropes? Like,
yeah. I guess it's obviously a cage match, so there's not any disqualification, and it, of course, it's a first blood match, so that doesn't matter. Yeah, I guess I feel like I see that so much in cage matches or in matches where it shouldn't happen. It's sort of something I sort of overlook now, but yeah, you're right. Obviously, breaking it there seems silly. So then Flair tries to slam Hogan's face into the cage, but Hogan turns the table. At this point, Hogan does 10 punches in the corner, although he actually stops at 8 and bites Flair's face. Mm-hmm. Flair's in anguish for a bit. He's tossed into the cage, and you certainly start to see more bleeding. He climbs up on top of the ropes, and Hogan pulls down Flair's trunks, although we don't really get a shot of Flair's ass.
I'm grateful that we don't see, like, saggy old man ass at this point.
Well, you know, I mean, Flair's was certainly better in 99 than it was today. Hard to believe that Flair was, you know, was considered super old, you know, 13 years ago, but...
That's if anybody's seen him lately, that's certainly like, what? That was the weird thing that occurred to me during his entrance that I didn't mention, as I was like, man, Flair looks pretty young and okay. And then I was like, did I think that at the time? And I'm like, no, I thought he was old as hell at the time. And he was old as hell at the time, which just means he's really goddamn old now.
Right. Yeah, he was 50 here. So, or I think he was just about turned 50. So,
yeah.
They both get atop the turnbuckle, and then Flair ends up getting crotched on the ropes.
Yeah.
Now, there's a decent amount of bleeding, so Tony and Tanay are trying to sort of explain, like, okay, you know, he's bleeding. Why aren't we, you know, sort of stopping this? Hogan grabs some barbed wire off the top of the cage, sends Flair into it, and now we're really bleeding a lot.
By this point, he is bleeding.
Yeah.
Like a stuck pig. He's bleeding.
He is definitely bleeding pretty heavily. So, you know, Hogan grabs his belt. He plays to the crowd. He slams. He hits Flair with the belt repeatedly. Flair tries to fight back, almost in a babyface fashion, but then is sent headfirst in the cage. We kind of have bigger Hogan chance at this point.
Yeah.
Hogan repeatedly sends Flair's head into the cage, and Tony sort of asks, like, "Isn't this supposed to be first blood match, what's going on? He's like, well, I guess we're just going to keep going with it. Which, you know, it makes sense for the announcers to be confused here. And it sort of reminds me, I just did a podcast on the Elimination Chamber of No Way Out 2009. And that's the one where Edge attacks Kofi Kingston and then takes his place in the Elimination Chamber and is allowed to be in. It's kind of
another wonderfully nonsensical moment in professional wrestling history.
Although that one, I mean, I think worked despite its nonsensicality just because of the shock and just because of how it was executed. This, obviously, not as effective. But I, you know, it's just sort of like, you know, what can you do? You know, it just, that's the story you're telling. So you just kind of have to go with it of being like, okay, well, it's confusing, but it's just sort of what's happening. So we have to call what's happening. So.
Right. Which I seriously doubt if the announcers knew what was going on. I feel like they're legitimately confused, and they're trying really hard to make themselves not look like complete dumbasses.
You may certainly be right. And WCW was notorious for not cluing its announcers on things. So
yeah, yep,
it makes more sense. Flair flops again. Hogan does a woo and gets a big boot, lands the leg drop for a pretty big pop. Charles, at this point, refuses to count. Hogan then points out the blood, saying, hey, he's bleeding, you should end this. And eventually Hogan grabs him by the throat. Flair grabs some nucks out of his trunks and nails Hogan in the head. Then sends him into the cage, repeatedly punches him in the head to a mixed reaction.
Yeah, and Tanay, during this exchange, points out again that pinfalls do not count in this match. But Hogan goes for a pinfall. He goes for another pinfall later, and then, well, we'll get to the finish when we get to the finish, I guess.
Well, he doesn't really, I mean, again, he doesn't necessarily have another choice because, hey, he, you know, what else can he do? But then again, he sort of went for the pinfall before he ever complained about the match not being ending with blood. So that would kind of went out of order.
Yeah, right, exactly. Yeah, Hogan doesn't spin it like at no point when he's grinding his head against the cage, when he's doing all that shit, he at no point does he go to Charles Robinson and go, look, he's bleeding, I win, right? Like, he never does that. He goes for a pin, and like you said, he goes for a pin, and then he, after Robinson will count, he goes, well, he's bleeding. You know, and it's like, and Robinson doesn't even, he like no-sells that. Like, Robinson's like, whatever.
Yeah. Then David Flair comes out in an NWA.
With Torrie Wilson,
who is referred to by Tony Schiavone as his gorgeous girlfriend. So I don't think she has a name yet, or she was called Samantha at one point, but they ended up going with her real name not long after this.
Right. Now at this point, there's blood everywhere. Like, everybody is bleeding. I'm surprised Charles Robinson isn't bleeding.
Yeah.
And the match has not ended.
There is heavy blood. So, Flair sends Hogan into the cage. There are cheers for Hogan. Flair hits a knee drop, and then Flair yells at David, calls him a punk, and spits at him and screams, I'm going to be the 14-time champion. Mm-hmm. So this is sort of one of the things that leads me to believe that we're meant to believe that Flair is kind of going crazy in response to what's happened with David. Or this also might communicate that Flair is selfish and doesn't care about David.
Right. And then he thrusts his dick at Torrie Wilson.
He does, indeed. Yes.
And as you said, he had just turned 50. Although this was around the time that, you know, that Viagra had just hit the market right around this time. So, hey, you know, maybe he can, you know.
Maybe he can go, you know, maybe Space Mountain's back again. You know?
Yeah, you know, it's, who knows. It's, you know, so after that, then this is where Hogan starts to Hulk up.
Right, yes. He, so Hogan pops up, sort of starts to Hulk up, like sort of like starts it and then stops it. Flair chops him in the corner, and then he hulks up again to a big reaction. He no-sells the chop, and he points. Hits the usual punches, big boots, does a running leg drop. Now, Robinson does a one count, but he won't do more. And then at this point, I believe it's Tanay who says, or maybe it's Tony.
Schiavone says referee's discretion.
One of them says, once again, we have to point out that this is a first blood match. So,
okay, I don't remember who said that, but then right afterward, Schiavone says that mentions the referee's discretion, and I just give him an A for effort there, Tony. A for effort, man. You're trying, but it's not working. Like,
and Hogan works Flair over in the corner. Flair is able to get the eyes, though, and the suplex.
Yep, and not just any suplex, like a Davey Boy Smith, you know, suspended suplex.
Long.
You know, which Hogan promptly no-sells.
Right. Flair popped up, and then Hogan does right now, and then a nice moment with Flair being like, oh, shit, and he gets down on his knees and begs off. And, of course, we've seen Flair do that a million times, but just the way he did it there was great.
Yeah, yeah.
Flair is, again, in the cage, you know, is really, really bleeding at this point. Flair in as a battering ram into the cage. Hogan tries another battering ram, but then Flair pushes him into Charles Robbins.
Why is there a ref bump in this match? Like, what possibly, you know what this is the problem with this match, and this is the problem with a lot of things that WCW do during its last 2 years, which is basically where we're at. We're right hitting like their last, this is the start of their last 2 years in existence. Or no, their last year. Yeah, no, it's 2 years. It was early spring of 2001, right? Is when they were no more. So we're at, and what they did during that last 2 years was, it just seems like like they had no restraint. There was no restraint in the name of telling a good and cohesive narrative. Yeah. It was just, well, you know, whatever, screw it. Let's just go, we'll put them in a cage and there'll be barbed wire and it'll be first blood, but not really. And we'll have a ref bump and we'll have David Flair come down. We'll have Arn Anderson come down. We'll have him thrust his dick at Torrie Wilson and blah, blah, blah. Like, whoa, man. Like, this story does not need that many elements, and all you're doing is clouding the water, you know, of telling a good narrative that exists here and trying to pull off this weird double turn. But David Flair's down there running interference for Hogan, and then Arn's down running interference for Flair, and there's bad referee Charles Robinson, and like, it just, it's a mess. It's, you know, it's like trying to make a soup with 17 ingredients, and you know, it's just, it's muddled.
It is indeed. So as Hogan tries to lift Robinson up, Flair gets the low blow. So I guess that's sort of the reason for the ref bump, is because it distracts Hogan so Flair can get the low blow, which is kind of silly because Flair could have pretty much done that at any point, but whatever.
Right, exactly. He could have done it at any time.
Right.
You know, he could have looked – Hogan could have been distracted by Torrie Wilson's tits. You know, half the dudes in the front row were. It's believable. You know, and it low blowed him there or whatever. It could have been anything. Robinson could have distracted him on purpose if they're trying to push, you know, bad referee, you know, Charles Robinson, the same way they did bad referee Nick Patrick 3 years before this.
Sure, sure.
You know.
Although I've always thought Robinson was less like bad referee as misguided referee because he loves Ric Flair so much.
Right. And that's, and you know what, that's the important thing. Because the thing with bad referee Nick Patrick is the bad referee Nick Patrick literally is just a bad referee. And they keep alluding to him, you know, this is towards the tail end of 96. They keep alluding to him being in the pocket of the New World Order, but he keeps blowing calls for heels, no matter if they're in the New World Order or not.
Right.
Like, he's just a bad referee. Like, he just makes bad calls and doesn't see things. He's like the replacement refs in the NFL.
Exactly.
You know, it's not like this made more sense because at least, you know, Lil Nate always made the calls for the Horsemen, but it wasn't like he went out there and, you know, blew calls for, I don't even know who else was he, like Sid or whoever, you know, other heels in WCW at the time.
Right.
You know, he only did it for the Horsemen. So that made a lot more sense than, yes, than bad referee Nick Patrick.
So Arn Anderson runs out. He nails David from behind.
Torrie Wilson looks like a deer in the headlights.
Yeah. She ends up jumping on Arn's back, and Arn tosses her off.
After he turns around to remind her to jump on him.
Yes. Torrie was spectacularly hot, though, at this point. I mean, not that she, you know, certainly was later, but man, at this point, when she was, you know, even younger, she was really, she was something.
She's easy on the eyes. I'll agree with that. She's not the type that I usually gravitate towards, but
not me either. But she really does, you know, she hits a special point in my heart. we'll say it's my heart anyway. So, then Arn hands Flair a tire iron, which he had also used to help the Horseman Benoit Malenko win the tag titles earlier this show. Flair nails Hogan in the head, then locks in the figure four. Robinson makes the three count, and we have a huge pop for the win. So Flair wins, and a huge reaction. Right away, Michael Buffer goes into a spiel of, you have just witnessed wrestling history, blah, blah, blah. Flair, Ric Flair is 14-time champion, so on and so forth. That moment was fine, but it really would have been better, like, if you had the Howard Finkel-esque delay before he makes the announcement of we have a new champion.
Yeah.
Thing. So, David Flair looks over Hogan, helps him up. The announcers kind of put over the fight that Hogan gave. I do love Heenan's line of, after, you know, the idea of the horsemen celebrating, of saying, I'm going to get some of that champagne, guys, and walking off right as the announcing goes off. So, yeah, the reaction, you know, if they're going for the double turn, which I'm not quite as convinced as what they were actually trying to do. I mean, they certainly are heading in that direction, but I think that's this is a first chapter to that rather than the final chapter. I still think there were a lot of problems with the execution that you went off, but if you kind of forget about the story that they're trying to tell and just to enjoy it as like a Flair, or, you know, more of the, just these two guys as the characters they pretty much always are in this, you know, cage match battle, I do think I enjoy a lot of it, and I do think that that it's, you know, it's pretty much Hogan and Flair kind of doing what they're doing, but it's, you know, it's energetic. I do kind of feel like it was sort of nice at some of the parts in which Hogan and Flair were almost equals. You treat as equals rather than Hogan being the dominant guy who always beats up Ric Flair. And you obviously get that more toward the end.
That's
but,
true.
But I do feel like it was like one of the more even matches that they ever had. And of course, you know, Flair actually winning a title match against Hogan is novel. So I appreciate it on those levels.
Yeah, it's, I guess I can kind of go there with you. I just don't like this match. I see your perspective. I just don't agree. I feel like they were really trying to push the double turn and they just failed. You know, they really dropped the ball on it. And I don't know. I feel like the narrative isn't cohesive, you know, in any valuable way. You know, it's like, it's just a catastrophe. Like the reaction to Hogan and the way that the hulking up doesn't make any sense. Like I said, there's so many elements, that the cage and the barbed wire and the gimmicks and the finish is just like, and again, I understand that they're going for, you know, that Robinson is in the pocket of the horseman, but it doesn't play that way. It doesn't come through, and the announcers don't do a good job of questioning it or putting it over. Like, they just keep saying like, well, referee's discretion, not like, yeah. Like, not like, what's he doing? Why isn't he doing it? Like, oh no, it's referee's discretion.
Yeah, they're confused, but they're not really questioning what's going on in any, like, they're not like enraged or like, you know, like, this is crazy or this is, you know, they're a little bit confused, but you're right. There's no like indignation, I guess.
Yeah.
Which you kind of would think there would be based on on what we think is the story they're trying to tell. So, yeah,
right.
It's, I mean, there's no question it's muddled in a lot of ways too, but there are things in it that I see that I enjoy. And I also wonder if contrasting this with the Bret Hart, Steve Austin double turn, which is one of like the best things WWE ever did. And it's just an incredible, you know, not just as a double turn, but as, you know, pretty much any angle they ever had. And I wonder if kind of the differences between Bret Hart as more of a wrestler who has a reputation for really thinking about what he does in the context of the story and really planning things out a lot. Maybe not like planning his matches move for move, but just kind of planning like where the match is going to go. Where I think Ric Flair has more of a reputation as kind of an instinctual wrestler, just kind of going with what feels right at the time. And of course, Hogan and Flair, they kind of seem to have that vibe where they had like a lot of, you know, pretty good matches where they kind of had the flow that they had, but it never really went up like more of a gear than it ever did. And I just wonder if maybe Hogan and Flair, because of the dynamic that they were, because of the type of wrestlers that they were, whether that was part of why the execution wasn't maybe as sound as it could have been.
I think that Flair, first of all, comparing anyone to Bret Hart, you know, including Hulk Hogan, especially Hulk Hogan, and even including Ric Flair in terms of, you know, narrative ability, you know, is kind of lopsided. You know what I mean? Like you're talking about someone who is considered to be one of the best in ring, not necessarily from the standpoint of obviously Bret Hart didn't have great promos, but in terms of his in ring psychology, his ability to compose a narrative and carry it through in the ring is damn near second to none. But I also think that Flair's ability to know where he's going with something and get there, you know, is not something to be... I think Flair should have known better. Not even that he should have known better, because I don't know about all that, but that he... you know, with WCW, it's hard to tell. Like, was any of this his idea? Or was it just this is the hand he was dealt, and so that's what he did, you know? And he made the best of a bad situation by making the match even watchable, you know, and bringing all of his energy to it, mm-hmm. which I allowed him for. You know, you never know with WCW, I guess. So,
yeah,
I don't know. But I think you're sort of selling Flair short and also excusing him, you know, at the same time.
Yeah, I mean, I obviously consider Flair one of the best ever, but for just kind of everything from what I've read, and I guess this is coming from Bret more than anyone, is that he was kind of a guy who was like, was sort of hard to follow sometimes when guys wrestled him, because he was just kind of all over the place a little bit with his psychology and so forth. And I've noticed watching enough of the Ric Flair matches, particularly the ones that are longer matches, is that he repeats what he does quite a lot, and he just sort of,
yeah, that's true.
There's always,
true. He's not Rob Van Dam, but you know, he definitely,
repeats stuff within a match too. It's not just repeating stuff like, you know, from match to match. I mean, everybody does that, but I just feel like there are times where, you know, and Flair is great, but there are times in which, the stories aren't quite like the stories more come from the angles that are leading to it and Flair's ability as a promo to build the stories, but as far as like the in-ring stories, it's not quite, you know, I don't know, it's just sort of something I was thinking based on you know, Flair's reputation more than anything else. Who knows, there's so many. I mean, I think we've outlined pretty much all the reasons it could be. I do feel like at this point, you know, even though WCW had been slumping for the last year or so, as far as in a lot of things, you know, they were still doing pretty well. I mean, they were definitely behind WWE, but as far as, you know, what they were doing, you know, in their business and in, you know, the ratings and buy rates and live attendance and all that, I mean, they were still doing fine. It certainly wasn't unsalvageable, and they certainly still had a very deep talent roster. I still feel like at this point, they could have turned it around without too much difficulty if they'd have had someone who, you know, was a strong leader, and if they'd have been able to get kind of all those egos on board with it, which really would have been the tough part, because, you know, a lot of it was just guys not willing to do what was best for the company, which, you know, would have been best for them long term anyway, most of the time.
Yeah.
So I do feel like they, you know, they kind of sidelined Goldberg during this time when his, you know, kind of revenge, you know, to get the title back should have been kind of the focal point. And it was cast aside for a while, and then, you know, obviously never really happened.
Yeah, so he was around, or was this when he was out for having punched through a window or something at this point?
No, that was later. He did get hurt, but and I think actually might have been around this time. He was back at Spring Stampede. He beat Nash. Even though Nash had kind of turned babyface at that point, it was sort of Goldberg's revenge for, you know, everything that happened with Nash. And he beat Nash clean. It's actually a pretty good match. And then he sort of was sidelined. He may have been out for a little bit again as well. They did the angle with him and Bret Hart where, you know, the famous one in Canada where Bret Hart had the breastplate underneath his jersey. And that was kind of supposed to lead to something. But then Owen died and Bret really couldn't be a heel at that point and didn't come back till the summer. And then they kind of had – I think they were doing some interesting things like – in the early fall, which was kind of after Bischoff left, and they sort of had like an interim booking reign, but then they went to Russo, and then they just it all kind of went to hell around that.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
But I mean, they still had, you know, they were having some really strong pay per views at this point. They still had a deep roster, even though
they did
clearly had its big flaws, and you mentioned a lot of them, but it still was a promotion, in me looking back on it especially, where there was a lot of great stuff going on, and I wish they had been able to keep it together and been able to thrive, obviously, because, you know, wrestling is worse off without having that strong, you know, rival to WWE.
Yeah. I would certainly agree with that.
Yeah. So anything else that you can think of talking about this match?
No, just again that it was so incoherent that it sort of I swore off WCW at that point. And I think I was also a really big Raven fan, and I feel like he's very close to the end of his run at this point as well.
He had a nice bounce back where he and Saturn were a team, and they teamed. They had a few matches against Benoit Malenko, and I think Ray and Kidman made a team around this time too. They kind of had a little mini revival of the tag team division through the spring and summer. And then I think Raven left toward the end of summer. I think it was like a thing where like Bischoff like invited anyone who was unhappy to, you know, walk out, and they would release some of the.
Yeah. Yep. That's exactly it. And he was like the only one who's, they said basically Bischoff had a meeting and said if anybody is unhappy, they can leave as long as they don't go to WWF for at least 6 months or something like that, or a year maybe it was.
Yeah.
And Raven stood up and said, all right, I'm out of here. Mm-hmm. So.
Yeah. So. Well, you want, of course, tell everyone a little bit more about What a Maneuver and anything else you want to bring up.
This is the part where I get to plug all my shit, huh? Okay. So, yes, I am the co-host of the What a Maneuver podcast, which you can find at onthestick.com because it is part of the onthestick.com podcasting network, which is comprised of three shows. The On the Stick biweekly video game podcast, the internet's foremost action movie podcast, The Action Cast, and What a Maneuver, which if you haven't listened to it, I would implore you to go check it out. Jason's been on the show with us, and that is a show where my co-host Eric and I go through, right now we are currently going through the entire year of 1996, Raw, Nitro, and pay-per-views, as well as Clash of the Champions, but we're out of those. There are only two of those. We've watched them already, but we're doing the whole year of 96. We were on a very short hiatus right now that is going to be over next week. We'll be doing a couple of double episodes to catch up because I was rehearsing a play and then Eric was on vacation. He went on a hiking trip. So we're kind of getting back into the swing of things. I'm going to post an episode probably before this goes up, unless you edit this really, really quickly. But probably tomorrow I'm going to post the episode covering War Games 96, which is the main event of that is a War Games match between Hall, Nash, Hogan, and Sting against Flair, Anderson, Luger, and Sting. And yes, I did say Sting twice. This is the fake Sting angle. And the Nitro and Raw that followed that. And then we'll be recording an episode covering Mind Games 96, which is a WWF pay-per-view. A lot of games going on in September of 96.
Yeah.
So that's going on over there. You can follow me on Twitter at @shake_well. And I will lead you to all of the things that I do, although I maintain there's a what. You can also follow at @what_a_maneuver. But anything important that comes from there also usually gets retweeted by me, myself. As the episode's going up, is also going to reveal the winner of our first What a Maneuver Twitter contest, where we gave away a Fire Ant mask. So listen, follow us on Twitter, and you may be able to win other cool stuff in the future.
Cool. All right, Joe. Well, thanks so much for being on the show. Always appreciate you being a part of it.
Yeah,
and, of course, you can check us out at WrestleSpective.com. We're on Twitter and Facebook as well. And please check out our sponsor, RotoReels.com, for great deals in wrestling DVDs and downloads. So thanks, everyone, for checking us out, and we'll be back again soon.